Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. By this point, you've probably heard the extra long episode, which is 2 hours with History Impossible and Secret Police podcast, and after which we were probably on a bunch of new lists then. As I've been working super heavily with all the war, and my next trip to Ukraine literally got pushed back a bit because one of my contacts died with the Minister of Interior, and now I'm stuck in a bit of paperwork limbo. I thought to remember some things that make me feel good, because during this whole tragic period of time, you have to relax sometimes. And I return to a popular subject of my Blighthard episodes, Paradox Gaming. And today with me here is Leith, who is here because A, I love his YouTube stuff. You should definitely go and check out his channel. And his channel name is also the reason why I should probably call him in. Social streamers, you know, I mean. So, hi Leith, and welcome to, I suppose, your first visit on a Brutal News and History podcast.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to ask you, how did you even end up, you know, starting to play Paradox games? And you're really good at them, though.
See, this is, I don't know about the really good start of the thing. I've just put a lot of hours into it. The story of how I got into them is a little bit mildly sad in terms of the fact that it was like 2013. A guy at my boarding school that played Europa Universalis 4, and I didn't have any friends. And so I pretended that I knew what he was talking about so that I could like be friends with him. So he was like, yeah, we'll play it. We'll play multiplayer. Like, and that'll be great. So then I had to quickly like go and buy the game and then study up about it to make sure that I could try and make a friend. And that turned out to be the best financial decision of my life. So yeah, went pretty well.
Oh, wow. Nice. I started slightly earlier. My foray into Paradox Grand Strategy was with CK2 original release. And then I played a bit of EU3, which I thought really awesome and well and great at the time. But if you look at it now, it's kind of like, how did we even manage to do this? And then I've been with EU4 since the beginning. And I'm also one of those very few people who actually enjoyed Imperator Rome at launch. I don't know why. I'm a massive minority here, but it is what it is.
I think a lot of people did. It's just it didn't quite pivot the way. It was one of those games that, like, they, in my opinion, prioritized the wrong things. Like, it's quite a wide game, you know? There's a lot to do, but there's no depth to it. So then the mechanics can't engage with, yeah.
I really enjoyed the fact that EU4 had these national ideas, and EU4 is such a deep game. But EU4, in a way, if you abstract it outside of the time period, it kind of shows you how countries function up until this day.
Yeah.
I mean, we still talk about Republican tradition because, you know, my primary education is political philosophy. We still speak about legitimacy. We still speak about Republican tradition. What we don't speak about is prestige, but it just exists there. It's just not polite to talk about it. I mean, there's a reason why people organize Olympic Games, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good little intro, I think, into the world of geopolitics from like a game perspective. Look, I'm not gonna sit here and say like, oh yeah, it's the equivalent of like a degree, but it does introduce concepts of like of geopolitics and that sort of stuff into people who wouldn't have seen it otherwise.
By the way, talking about history, one thing that I really wanted to say thank you about is the fact that you do all the shorts, and not only about EU4, but you do about historical generals on the whole field.
Yeah, it's just a fun little pivot.
I, for one, had never seen this Akukonyu general. in my life, and actually hadn't, you know, studied about him as well. So that was a surprise to me.
Well, the awesome thing about those kinds of things, and I love two things in history. I love unknown and unsung heroes and underdogs. And Akinyulu was both of those things, right? So it's a tiny state surrounded by its neighbors. And then this one guy goes and conquers a huge, massive swathe of territory and was only really defeated once or twice against the Ottomans right at the end. And if he'd won that, he'd been one of the greatest conquerors of the age. But he didn't. And so he just sort of slipped into the annals of history. There's something like quite poetic about that, that you can, in those like sort of couple of decades that he reigned, was the biggest thing around. And then we don't remember him at all.
Kind of interesting, because one of the people that we actually do remember, and if you've played Transoxiana, you get the event of building an observatory, and you have this famous Muslim medieval kind of, I always forget his name. For unknown reasons, we have a statue of him here in Riga. But I wanted to ask you, because I live in Riga, and this is Latvia now, and previously to 134 patch, and again, this is going to be interesting only to people who play the game, but hey, my show, and I get to relax at some point. So you'll get your more episodes later. I had done the achievement of Terra Mariana before Riga, when they had like their very default mission tree, but it was like never fun.
Yeah.
Like, you couldn't do anything that special. And then I was always, you know, watching people playing their home nations and doing all that stuff. And especially what makes me angry is whenever Slavic tries to play Poland, it's just... and then you just... so enthusiastically you start talking about how you play Tunis. And maybe that's my bias, because I'm the kind of person that can't live peacefully if any of my provinces are below 20 development.
Right.
I like to play super tall, and I'm the guy who plays until 19th century. I literally finish 90% of my games up until the very end. I like coal.
One of those guys.
Look, I don't have time to restart many times. I do that very early or something. I have my single game, and then I basically play for 2 hours, and then I go away for 2 days because stuff, and then I just come back to it. It's kind of weird, because I know that a lot of people who play these games just play in one sitting.
Of course.
I can't do that. I play for 2 hours and just pause and everything. So that is why it doesn't really, you know, bother me to play until the end. It's always kind of interesting and fun. I do get to see coal bonuses, and I do actually see revolutionary republics. That's a really fun mechanic that no one gets to see. It's awesome. I always wondered why people consider hordes broken, and I really hate playing anything that's not Eastern or Western tank group, because I know that once I'll get to that very late stage, then even Ottomans, they get, you know, beaten back and all that stuff. You playing Tunis so much, which I never even considered playing, because it's a Muslim tank group, I'll play it up until the end, it's going to be super weak at the end. And you taught me that I could totally try this. I would have never even tried to play Timurids without this. It's weird. So you taught me something new. You like playing Tunis, I suppose, because you're Optimesian or something. And then 134 came out and I got to play Riga. Oh, that was just amazing.
I think there's always like a bit of pleasure in playing your own sort of hometown, isn't there? You make them fulfill what you think there.
Talking about Riga, there's a tiny little mistake that you can get the cathedral in like in 1450. By
of course
the way.
You can.
I was so angry because I figured that one out, and then I watched. I think it was the Red Hog's guide, and he didn't do it, even though he could.
I'll yell at him for you. Don't worry.
Out of all the YouTube guides that I watched, because I basically watched you, I watched Red Hog, and then I sometimes watched Ludi, but Ludi is just too cringy for me sometimes. So. When I started playing this game, we didn't have you guys. We had Flutty Worry and Corbett Gaming. And
of course.
I don't even know what they're doing these days.
Well, Corbett's still chugging on making content. And Flurry's been a mainstay of the Twitch scene for a long time. But I think there's definitely been... I think there was more of a concentrated audience back in the day. You had like ISP making E4 content. DDR Jake was also doing that sort of stuff. And then I think nowadays is like we enter into a modern era of content creation in EU4. I think there are fewer players playing E4, but the depth of gameplay and the development is completely different. I'm in a bit of a unique situation because I made content like 5 years ago, and then I took a sort of 3-year break, and then I came back. So when I say I made content up until about 10,000 subscribers. Like, it was not that big at all. So I got to see like the evolution of it. So back in the day, you make multi-episode things, right? So your episode 34 is still going to be around. Whereas you can't do that in modern day. The game has completely changed for the better. And I think that there's so much competition that, no, I wouldn't say competition because it implies that like we're competing against each other. We're not. We're just sort of like when something works, then it helps the entire scene develop into a more like coherent and edited style. And I think that's better. So I think the production value nowadays is higher than what it once was, because it has to be.
I think I do my podcast, and I have really noticed in a way that I get a very older audience, because my audience are the people who don't watch videos, they drive to work, and then they listen to the show. But also, I've noticed, because the guys who host me, Acast, they also just randomly slap in my stuff to YouTube, which always gets demonetized instantly. I don't even bother to check. Apparently, I have some tiny viewership there. One thing that I can do, which you can't, is that I can call war war, and I can talk about suicides and murders and all that stuff, and no one's going to stop me. Mm-hmm. This really kind of irks me about a lot of people who make political content. But does this YouTube algorithm thing, do you have to like self-censor sometimes how you speak about historical events and all this mechanics and stuff when you make videos?
I think it comes down to the person, really, and how they think that they should come across. For example, I won't cuss in my videos at all. That's not just because it's advertiser friendly and that sort of stuff, because I want to appeal to a broad spectrum of people. When you delineate between what you are and aren't going to talk about, I think that when you remove things like talking about suicide or something like that, I mean, I'll make mild like jokes and references, but I won't make particularly dark jokes that I might make outside of recordings, because I want my recordings and my content to be a place where a lot of different people from different walks of life can come watch. So I tend to avoid political things, because I don't, frankly, at that point in time, if you're watching my videos, it's going to sound kind of corny, but I'm there to entertain and I'm there to amuse. I'm not there to make a point. I'm not there to do anything else. So I tend to like self-censor, not because I fear reprisals from like ad revenue, but because if there is a chance that someone would be turned off by the content because of something that I can quite easily control, I don't see the downside. If it's not going to harm the overall quality of the video, I'll still make certain jokes. I'll still discuss certain things. Or for example, if I'm in a group setting, I'll tend to use more free language, because that's just how the dynamic works. But for the most part, I'll tend to try and make it as consumable for everyone as possible.
In my case, when I started out, my initial episodes were about Soviet Army, and then I made one about gulags. And once you've made an episode about gulags, then you kind of...
yeah.
Well, then there's kind of no going back, really. I introduced a lot of Soviet political jokes. I never get to talk to a lot of dedicated YouTubers that often, so I'm just kind of sharing the experience of the craft, so to speak. it's weird. One of the other questions I want to ask you is that, you know, we've spoken about playing your home region, and we spoke about how this can be used to. What do you think is the least historical thing in EU4 that you know, sometimes maybe irritates you, or you think that should be totally handled differently?
Okay, so there's... Because there are things that are ahistorical that I still enjoy. And I think that's the part of it being alternate history, is that you can open up the scope a little bit to being things that are mildly ridiculous. And I think there's lots of examples of that. For example, the Teutonic order reforming into a horde, right? Going eastwards. That's completely ridiculous and ahistorical, but also a lot of fun. But you see, for example, the earlier mission trees, like the Ottoman mission tree, it's not fun. And it is kind of historical. So I don't know that there's a correlation between ahistorical and something being frustrating. I don't know. I think that there's not enough of an emphasis on the papal states and the Pope and the papal interactions. And the Pope was a lot more important, and not just a temporal, but as a secular leader in this time period. And I don't think that's stated. Like, you can just treat the Pope as any other, beyond like one malice for occupying Rome, you can treat the Pope like any other geopolitical state. And that's just not really the case, and that's why it stuck around for centuries.
Even today, if you look at the Pope is a hugely important figure in the Catholic world, and like, if you travel through Poland, you'll see lots of statues of John Paul II. Like, just as everything in the United States, like in Boston, is named after Paul Revere, if you go to Warsaw, you'll see John Paul II everything. I find very strange how a lot of natives are handled in a bizarre way, because I have tried to play in Australia and all this Polynesian stuff, and I just don't really understand what do you do with these guys. It's just
flavor for flavor's sake. Yeah, it's not great. The interesting thing, though, when you talk about Catholics, when you talk about like the Polynesians and stuff, and this is something I touched on in a recent video, just it occurred to me, and then I had to like dance around the topic a little bit because I didn't want to upset anyone. But the idea that, I mean, religions in the game are a mechanic, right? If you are Catholic, Anglican, we spoke just briefly before the podcast about Riga being Anglican and how you can use the mechanics.
There is a basis of this, just happened a bit later. Riga has a single Anglican church. Wrong.
It's historical, boys. We made it. There's one church.
This study is even more ridiculous because the British they also had a Muscovy trading company, just lesser known than the Indian one, but they had a Muscovy trading company.
Yes.
So while Riga was part of Russian Empire at that time, but it had huge autonomy because it should technically be a vassal, as you are incentivized to keep it in the game. Riga had a bunch of British mayors. A first British mayor built our first children's hospital and all that stuff, but about in 1806, if I'm not mistaken, it's like early 19th century. Officially, the religion is Orthodox here. Mm-hmm. Although we have a bunch of Protestants who are the local both Germans and all that stuff, but the Anglican merchants, they're a huge community. They've pushed out all the Hanseatic merchants and stuff, and they decided they want an Anglican church. But at that point, the Russian Empire had decided to do their campaign of Russification, just, standardize everything, mm-hmm. Basically, click the lower autonomy button on all of our provinces.
Yeah.
They literally signed an ukaz, which is kind of this governmental order, about that there shall be no Anglican church on Orthodox soil. But the problem is, according to some various bizarro church rules, it's like 6 feet. Your blessed soil goes 6 feet. Mm-hmm. So sneaky British, they literally stuffed in like a bunch of ships filled with soil on the plot of land that they bought. Literally 6 feet, and then they built the Riga Anglican Church. So yes, there is a single Anglican church in the Riga.
It works. I love little historical stuff like that where people use quirks, and it's just, they're great.
The problem is that you don't get an event to convert to Anglican. You actually have to do it by conquering London. And I like the fact that they pay attention to this. There is one single event, by the way, that I still poke about paradox about it every Christmas. Because Riga has a legitimate claim, like documented claim, on having the first actual decorated Christmas tree ever.
Oh.
Because at that point, we were a Germanic city, and we had this place in the Riga city center called the Blackhead's House, which was basically a guild hall, but not for local merchants, for all the foreign merchants that would come there. We have this first documented case of a Christmas tree being brought out and decorated and people, celebrating stuff around. Now, obviously, it had happened somewhere previously in Germany or something, because Hanseatic city at the time. However, we have the claim on documentation, and that was the one thing that I really, really asked Paradox to just... They made a whole soundtrack that only plays in December, which I love, by the way. And they can't give one tiny event that would give us 5 prestige? Come on!
It'd be broken. It's too much. Well, I think it's interesting you bring that up, because the events, I believe, are what make E4, like, replayable and, like, immersive. People really, like, they just click through them. Like myself, I'm very guilty of this because I've seen so many events. I'll just click through them really, really quickly. But that's the key part of the game, because it makes different nations feel different, right? If you didn't have that, I mean, look at, for example, Victoria 3, right? Without as many events, and it just doesn't make it feel as immersive. So things like, Riga has the first Christmas tree. Yeah.
I sadly haven't yet played Victoria 3. It's sitting on my computer, but I simply don't have the time right now. But these events, one thing that literally changed is the fact that when I play on my home computer, the big, powerful machine that holds all my recordings and everything, then I also click through it because, you just play on speed 5, it's super fast. But when I switch on to my work laptop, which I have diligently modified to be able to run everything, my speed 5 is basically speed 3 anyways, and I play, like, slowly. And then I understood that the favorite things they've written for the events is actually pretty nice. I highly recommend people do listen to that.
It is. There is value in sort of taking your time. I can't do it. I'm hardwired to just go speed 5 and pause as little as possible. But it is sometimes nice to just sort of take your time and peter through it.
The other thing that I find sort of strange is that I gave Tumis a try after you inspired me to. And I was surprised about how, I've been so focused on playing Western Nations and all that stuff, and I've been looking always at the big picture, because like I said, I'm one of those weirdos who actually care about later dates, that I only started to understand that the later dates will come only like 300 years after the beginning of the game. So that maybe I do not have to drag all my cold provinces to Bev 20 at the very start. It's kind of weird. There's still a button that I just refuse to click, and I can't force myself exploit development. I can't click that. It is heresy.
Your thing is, you say you're a fan, but you're a filthy playing tool guy. I don't understand you. You're like developing all your provinces. It's crazy to me.
Look, the first thing that I played and learned how to play was Florence.
Yeah.
I started out in Italy. So for me, Italy is the default of how it should be everywhere. And when I see a province with just three development, I'm like, what is this? This is when I tried to fall asleep when I was in Mykolaiv in the front lines. I was literally listening to your show. We had no internet. I had downloaded all this stuff. You know, rockets are exploding outside of my window about 100 meters from me. I'm listening to you because otherwise I'll just panic.
Right.
And then I run out of you. And then I have to start thinking about this and use my thing. I think in a way people haven't thought about this playing tall and playing wide thing. If you think about it, like Poland has a lot of missions to develop the country of Poland, a lot of it. But Poland's a big country with a lot of provinces. So when I play Poland, it's really tedious to develop things. Meanwhile, when you play some sort of Italy or Riga, like you click the buttons, everything goes out. And then I understood one interesting thing which balances out tall play. See, your monarch point generation is not related to how many provinces you have. So the more provinces you have to still use the monarch points for everything else.
Yeah.
If you leave AI just there and alone and doing its own thing, then you get like higher development provinces. This is how you get like higher development stuff.
Yeah, it also depends on your terrain. Also, you just glossed over one of the most insane things I've ever heard in my life. You just casually drop that. Oh yeah, yeah. You're listening to me whilst there are rockets like landing 100 meters away. Like I don't know. I don't feel like my cadence lends itself to sort of.
I've also driven a tank. I've been to the front lines a couple of times. My show covers the war.
No, I know. I've listened to it, man. Very well.
When the war started, I went from like, okay, we will put the Soviet history stuff on pause, and now this is a war news show. And, you know, it's kind of,
yeah.
You'll probably understand this because it's hard to explain this to people who, you know, who have just Western, like many Western mentality.
Mm-hmm.
We were the last pagans of Europe, and we still have these many pagan traditions here. Our administrative divisions are still like old pagan tribes. Like the provinces that you see on the map are basically what we were dividing our countries today. And we have like these other celebrations, and we still have this, some sort of weird honor culture remaining.
Yeah, of course.
Which I know is very strong also in Arabic countries in that area. And we have this feeling. So standard Western people who have just that experience and that culture, to them, hypocrisy is a forgivable thing. Like they don't treat it as something special. Meanwhile, I know that in our culture, traditional culture, no man. If I am to do something and make and inform you about the happenings of the war and not go there, then you know what's the point?
It's a form of hypocrisy. Yeah, completely understand.
So this is why I have to go there. This is why I do. But let me tell you, it's surprising how human beings get adjusted to literally everything. First time something exploded next to me, I was panicking. But on day four, you're like, okay, I can't record and I can't do any work until 2 a.m. because then the rockets are going to come. Yeah, you know, let's watch what the social streamers have uploaded.
But that's also something else that you've gone, yeah, okay, I'm just going to go and see what the social streamers are uploading.
One thing though, which I'm glad to speak with you now. When are you going to Ul?
Oh, yes, the own trip. So
I have literally set aside money because I want to go to Ulm as well, as I have never been there, and I heard it's a beautiful city. I've met every listener of mine that comes to Riga. If you will ever visit Riga, it's not that you know, expensive, I will take you on a tour, but you'll get a lot of free beer.
Awesome. I'll be glad to take you up on that.
Of course. That's a matter of honor for me. but yeah, so I'm still waiting for that Ulm trip because... I'd be glad to go.
Well, the Ulm trip. Okay, let me explain the Ulm trip. So, for context, those people don't know, part of the whole celebration of hitting 100,000 subscribers on YouTube was that me and the guy that I used to do the channel with, Tom, would go to Ulm. When we started to get close to 100K, the guy that I made the channel with started to step away from the channel more and more. So when we hit 100K, he's now, we hadn't announced at that point, but he's now basically stepped away. So it was just me doing the work. I'm happy to go to Ulm alone. It's just I didn't want to disappoint the audience by him not being there because he went into full-time employment, right? So him going to a meme city for a channel that he used to be a part of isn't exactly a priority. So trying to coordinate with him has been quite difficult. So I was sort of faced with a choice. Either I go alone or I try and figure things out with him until he has a break. As time has gone on more and more, that's become less and less likely. But it's also had the added effect of I've brought in a lot of the current audience has never seen Tom, like the audience has grown, you know, a good like 50,000-60,000 of without him ever being on the channel. And so now I feel like I'm in a good position this year to go to Ulm on my own without disappointing people. So it is still in the works. It's still happening. It's been a shame that not being done. Because it's one of the most asked questions. Because for me, I hate not fulfilling promises and obligations. So it's still there. You know what I mean?
I know this. And this is one thing that I really find fascinating, because I listened to a podcast when I was, you know, studying all about the tribes of Arabia. And I'm listening about the Arabic culture and understood that it's a very similar sort of structure in a way. And the values are kind of, if you kind of remove the Islam part, of course, because that's a very specific thing. But those traditional things about how everything's very honor-based, because it, over there, everything's basically just sand and you have like your livestock, right?
Yeah.
And over here, we had our own like Viking guys, like the Coronians who raided. But everything else is like swamp and forest. We're super forest and super swampy. If you look at the map where Mongolia, where the Mongol Empire ended, and then you look at the modern day Europe map, you'll see that it literally ended in the borders of Latvia and Lithuania, because this is where the forests start, the swamps start happening.
Yeah.
So I find that fascinating very much.
Well, yeah, it's interesting how the geography of a place in a nation state influences the culture. Like you say, it's a complete desert. So we've got extreme levels of hospitality. Like if someone comes to my house, Even now, and again, I'm half English, half Tunisian, so I can take lessons from both. But if someone to come to my house right now, I have to, if they want to stay a week, I'll house them, I'll feed them. I need to make sure that they're perfectly comfortable. Everything has to be put on hold for them. Because in a desert culture, right, if you refuse someone hospitality, then they might die. But then there's also, people don't understand the flip side of that as well, which is if you refuse someone hospitality, and this is the carrot and the stick approach, right? It's a really lovely thing to think, oh, well, it's really nice. You're trying to save someone's life. The flip side of it is, if the guy at your door knows that he's going to die if you don't let him in, he's going to try and force his way in and steal your stuff. So it's sort of, it is that carrot and stick of like extreme hospitality to, and it comes from a beautiful, lovely place. But at the same time, I'm pretty sure it was also 50-50 born out of the fact that the guy would rather burn you down than die himself. So
there's a reason why I take it very seriously, because, you know, I'm in Latvia. We're in the middle of nowhere. Like, it's super cold here. Our winters are about the same level as Finland. The rivers freeze over. It's minus 10 degrees. We don't have a lot of arable land. We have lots of forests, swamps, and then it's cold here. Like, even to this day, if you look at migrants and refugees who come over from Europe, right? European Union told us to take a bunch of them in. We did. And then they all left because no one wants to live in Latvia because it's cold. That's the thing. And if someone who's a listener of mine has come to my tiny little country of 2 million people to see me from the United States, oh yeah, I better give them a tour.
Of course.
Offer people a place to stay. I have a special couch for anyone who wants to stay.
Special couch.
This is my full-time job. And thankfully, because of how everything costs in Latvia and you know, listener base, I can do this. But it's the same hospitality rules, and this is why also the ultimate crime that you can do is betraying that hospitality. Oh, you're fucked then. You're fucked then.
Of course. Yeah.
I also don't know how exactly do I feel about all the tech groups in EU4, but not because, you know, at the beginning, you know, they had tech penalties, and that was to simulate kind of the technological development. But that thing is also what I find really bizarre, because I can tell you the exact moment, because in CK2 era, China is always more developed than Europe.
Yes.
What really crushes China down is the fact that we drink wine and they drink tea.
Right, okay.
I'll explain to you why. I studied this one. This is a huge in-depth concept, but it's true. Think about this. Wine is pretty and red.
Right.
You want to look at it. So you have glass industries. But in China, you have porcelain for the tea because tea is not as pretty.
Right, that makes sense.
So what happens is glassmaking, which leads to lenses, which leads to glasses, which allow people to kind of, you know, keep their productive scientific work for longer. Just because we decided to go glass because of wine instead of porcelain because of tea gave us a prolonged advantage, because turns out if you have like glasses, then you can be productive for 20 years more. And an educated man in those times that can work for 20 years more is a lot of scientific advancement generated.
It's incredible how like little one thing leads to another. You know what I mean? Like adjacent industries can just make this go. Because I mean, I would say up until probably the Enlightenment era, a lot of science was just mistakes, really. Like there wasn't really a concerted, until like chemistry and everything takes off, there's not really a concerted effort to run experiments because you know what's going to happen. It's more or less, let's like, oh, here's an accident happened. Like go as far back as like the Iron Age, right? Some guys put some rocks presumably next to a fire. And then when they came back to their fire, there's something silver leaking out of the rocks. Yeah, because they heated it up. And it has to be a certain type of rock and a certain type of riverbed. And yeah, things progress from there.
But one thing that I don't get is I've always had this idea for a movie in my head, and I don't know why Hollywood hasn't made it yet. Think about this. It's a prehistoric action flick. A random hunting party goes and hunts out a mammoth or whatever. All of them die except one dude, and then he sees lightning strike a tree, and then he discovers fire for the first time, and he's super far from his tribe. Imagine this, the first guy ever who brought fire to his tribe through all this stuff. You can have like attacks by tribal tribes, you can have like animals, dinosaurs, all sorts of danger. And this one guy trying to preserve the embers, you would have very minimalistic dialogue, it would become very artsy. But that would be a cool storyline.
It would. I don't know how historical it'd be, but yeah, it would be interesting for sure.
I mean, look, at some point in history, people have had to discover some...
So it depends how you delineate people. Because if you go far back enough, you know, there's obviously different groups and different everything, right? Different classifications. So I think a lot of people's definitions of humans are Homo sapiens, despite the fact they were like other types of humans. It's great. People don't realize that we killed other species of humans. You know what I mean?
I think we mostly absorbed them as well, because we have like all sorts of...
Yeah, it was absorbing, out hunting. Because also the Neanderthal way of hunting was like a bit more...
My girlfriend's a geneticist.
Yeah?
So. Yeah. So.
So she knows all about her.
It's kind of weird. It's kind of... Oh, yes, to your audience who are probably going to come over and listen to my show, this is not a typical episode. Typical episodes consist of me talking about horrors of war. That was the stuff that I'm probably going to hit a bit more uncomfortable things. Russians these days, and I'm going to be talking about the war, I'm watching Russian propaganda. I have leaks on Russian Putin's instructions, what he's given out to all these channels. And currently, they're into a phase where they try to prove that there's actually NATO soldiers fighting for Ukraine, which is a lie, by explaining that, oh, we blew up this building and there were X many black people there. Because they kind of, you know, Russia apparently has no black people. Even though, another piece of trivia, Pushkin, the father of Russian literature, was black. Just saying. Well... His grandpa was black, but he was black by the standards of the era. So, and I had my American friends on the show. And we spoke about this, and I started to think that, in a way, we're kind of blessed in over here, because you are a fellow European, like I am, and they also have a very interesting question about this, because you know, once you go to America, their racial politics become bizarre, which I don't understand. And we started to talk about this very concept of whiteness. And then I asked them, okay, would you consider like, you know, people from Spain white? How about from Tunis, right? Because I've been there. I've seen the ruins of Carthage and all this stuff. And to me, for a European, it's like, yeah, obviously. And I understood that we in Europe probably care more about cultures.
Right.
And then it's kind of shifted over to this because of how they work. And in portraying this question is the fact that, have you received any... kind of racial abuse or racial controversy thing from some of your haters from the United States or something? And I have this theory that we in Europe, at least, because we fought each other for such a long time, that for us, I think, is the more culture that matters than, you know, anything else.
So from the English side of things, my English half, barely ever, right? But the Tunisian half, like, that is, it's pretty prevalent. It's pretty common, right? Both in Europe and also in the UK and everything else. It's a pretty... standard thing. If you want to actually get a bit more serious with it, I would say that in terms of, and this isn't me trying to play a victim or anything else like that, but in terms of like racism, right, being racist towards like Arabs and Muslims and that sort of like ilk is generally less controversial than others, because I would argue of the representation in media of those different groups. Right. If you look at like first person shooters or Netflix shows or this sort of stuff, usually the bad guy is a North African or Arab man or this sort of stuff. So it is kind of like it is a thing. Right. In terms of North Africans being white, I don't think there's much point in broad stroking people. Like you say, culture is more important. It's more of a delineating factor than race in the old world.
I had to mention this because my audience is 80% American, and for them it's a big deal, so this is why I'm bringing up these topics, because, hey, whom else are going to ask? You're the only Tunisian person that I've ever spoken to in my life, except guys who were trying to sell me stuff on the market and that I understood very quickly just to pass it.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, it's. Well, I mean, if you want to talk about America specifically, right now, I have been to America before on an ESTA waiver, and that was all fine. And because of the Tunisian half, that has been revoked. I applied for a tourist visa because I wanted to go and visit my sister. Back in actually, it's been about a year. I went to the embassy, did the interview, and everything else. And because I'm half Tunisian, literally, it's one of the stated reasons. It's kind of hidden. You have to go through like the Indian embassies. Or Indian consulate's website, but that's where they show a list of nationalities that will be automatically submitted for administrative processing, right? And Tunisia's on that list. And I've been in that like bureaucratic limbo for the last like year. Nothing I can do about it. No updates, nothing like that. And so I can't, for example, go in. Even though I've been to the US and visited it, and I've, there's like nothing to suggest that I couldn't, I'm not able to. My mother, on the other hand, who is fully English, went through the same process as I did. It took about 3 days. Goes to the embassy, all fine. There's like, when it comes to, I don't want to call that racism as such, but like when it comes to discrimination based on nationalities and that sort of thing, and yeah, it's being a North African is going to be a bit different.
Even though I'm considered super white by American standards, I can relate to you because I'm from Eastern Europe and everyone knows British attitudes and French and all these attitudes towards Eastern Europeans. Thing is that I remember one of the very first studies that my parents told me is that, you know, it's late 80s, 89 or something, and the first border opens between Hungary and Austria. All these college age kids, they're like, they wear their best jeans smuggled in, and they're like, yeah, we're finally going to go and see something. And, you know, these super enthusiastic people who want to get out of this socialist country that's been oppressing them, they're the guys who are just going to look at everything starry-eyed and take pictures because they have never seen these things because it was like a curtain, right? And then Dad told me what really shocked him because, you know, he exits the train station in Vienna and he's like super happy and ready to finally, you know, for the first time in his life to see something beautiful. And the first thing he sees exiting the train station is a huge kind of sign in a cafe stating that Eastern Europeans go back and steal your own homes.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that Paradox also doesn't represent in CK2 as well, do you know when Northern Crusade actually was kind of declared? I mean, sure. Arabs, Islam, whatever. But over here, at the time of Northern Crusade, part of Baltic's like a region was Orthodox. They didn't care. The papal bull was released that stated that the Baltic peoples are actually not white, so it's cool to kill us.
Yeah, I remember that.
But then again, what's interesting is the fact that as I'm a person that criticizes Soviet Union a lot, not a fan personally, half of my family died to Stalin's repressions and stuff. What's interesting is that in our own language, the word Baltic, we have the word Balts, right? It literally means white. So in our own language, we are the white people. When someone starts throwing white power at them, you can ask them, oh, are you Latvian or Lithuanian?
Which one?
Yeah, which one? Because there's like two. I don't know. Like, there must be some other people who call themselves the white people, but there are us. We have this whole sea, you know, named after our people because, again, cultural things, because Daugava was kind of the entry point of all the Varangians who went down to Constantinople. So in our excavations, we have like 9th century Cordoba coins here.
Yeah.
It's like, and in a way, this is also another thing because those people who are like prejudiced, a lot of people tend to think that the world kind of was, the globalism was modern invention.
Yeah.
Now, we had like Arab traders here in the 9th century, and then, you know, ancient Romans and ancient Chinese knew about each other.
Yeah, people got around.
Well, I guess North America got a bit shafted because they kind of got isolated.
Yeah, they got isolated, and also you've got the direct, like, obviously, look, importing of slaves was a thing everywhere, but the sort of quantity that happened, and I don't think I'm even remotely qualified to talk about racial politics, to be blunt, but I think... In Europe, you have like a slow introduction and like you say, on the peripheries, right? You have Arab traders and that sort of thing, right?
This is not YouTube. Over here, my audience knows that we have like limits of our competence. And if you make mistakes, they will not yell at you. There is no comment section. There is no comment
section. Are you sure?
You know, instead of comment section, I have one star iTunes reviews.
But there's another problem. See, I'm banned from entering Russia. Putin has literally threatened to kill me. I've been beaten up by Putin's thugs on the street. And Putin's troll farm is literally just slamming with one-star reviews constantly. So if someone actually doesn't like what I do, yeah, go on. Add another one of my reviews there.
Yeah, but I might get a mean tweet.
By the way, you should follow me on Twitter as well, because Twitter is my main social media thing where I... @Eastern_Border.
Hello there, and thanks for listening to another episode of The Eastern Border. Dear Patreons, thank you more than ever for supporting our show. Your donations are crucial to keep us going, and right now all of your money is going to securing good information for you and to fund Kristaps's actual real-life mission to Ukraine to report to you live about the war that is going on there. Also, we would like to use this opportunity to urge you to donate to other organizations that are helping people escape Ukraine safely and to defend the country for those who decide to stay on the ground. One such organization we would like to highlight is the Defending Ukraine Together Come Back Alive movement. Launched in 2014, the Come Back Alive became the biggest organization providing support to the armed forces of Ukraine. You can donate directly from their webpage, comebackalive.in.ua. Remember that no donation is too small. In this situation, every dollar matters, every cent matters. If you're uncomfortable with giving money to war, they do have a position on their website that they are providing Ukrainian army with laptops, lights, photo equipment, cables, and is not purely military. Perhaps that might change your mind, but remember you can also donate to strictly humanitarian organizations such as the Red Cross and others that are helping people escape Ukraine safely. Please also keep following us on social media for all of your latest updates on Eastern Border on places like Twitter and Facebook. Keep listening, keep yourself informed. That's all from me now. See you online.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is why I became a journalist. You know what's the biggest, like, most awesome thing about journalism? You have to be polite in your everyday life and everything. Someone's like just, you know, scamming someone, you know, these Ponzi scheme guys or corrupt politicians. Then you can go guilt-free on their asses.
See, now that's how I feel just about normal people. So it's great. Guilt-free. Just go for it. I enjoy a struggle. You know what I mean? And that's why I like parallel sims and everything else. If you translate that to its extreme with, like, for example, putting on a shock collar, and if I get things wrong, I get zapped, or like I'll do these things called wheel streams where, like, it's me versus the audience. The audience are trying to stop me from getting an achievement.
I think it's also a cultural thing. You know why? Because, for example, money that you earn always kind of, you know, you value it more than the money you've been just trying to get. The struggle gives you the whole reward thing. The main lesson about this episode is that a Latvian man finds out he has a lot in common with Tunisians.
Latvian man becomes Tunisian, I think.
It kind of feels fair. It feels earned. That's why, for example, never play Spain. Study Spanish people. But it's just too easy. And Ottomans as well. It's just kind of...
Yeah. I'll always prefer playing smaller nations where there is, like... the struggle, you know, that's always going to be more entertaining. Or we have to try and take, like, my favorite videos, and it also translates into a lot of times my most popular videos, are ones where I'm situated right next to the Ottomans, right? Because again, underdogs, they're fascinating in media. They're fascinating in life. Everyone loves an underdog. So if you're situated next to the Ottomans, you're automatically an underdog.
If you know what to do in the game, you can, like, pick Venice, crush Ottomans. Pick Florence, crush Ottomans. Pro tip, it's actually super easy to crush Ottoman. Unless you're playing there.
Yeah, right? Okay. I'll peel back the curtain a little bit. All right, this is exclusive. The games that I play, I will a lot of the times make outlandish and ridiculous and frankly downright stupid decisions to keep things entertaining. Because I've got like 3,500 hours in the game, right? I'm pretty good at it. I like recently participated in Speed 5 where people were surprised like that I, up until the final to be fair, that I swept everyone, right? Because I'm pretty good at the game. I just, when I'm recording, there's a difference between like...
making content and playing yourself, yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's the fun part.
I can't really tell you how many hours I have, but I've played since day one. I still, by the way, also don't play CK3 because my favorite country to play in CK2 was Venice. I love playing Merchant Republics. It was great.
You just love playing tool all over the place, don't you? Doesn't matter what game. You're a filthy playing tool enjoyer.
What do you mean filthy playing tool enjoyer? You're the kind of person that likes playing, ooh, I'm going to play some horde and burn stuff to the ground. I like spending tons of time moving my units and fighting rebels.
Oh, that must be so hard. Look. Right, when I first started playing E4, it was Tunis, it was four provinces, right? And they were all one development, and it was all desert. You had to move, or you would die. We weren't developing. We couldn't play at all.
When I started playing Riga was like a single province with no ideas and a barely center of trade and would be like instantly attacked by Denmark. You had to restart the game until Denmark wouldn't just crush you. I don't know why they were so hardcore about getting Riga, but like, it doesn't matter your strategy or anything, because you can't beat Denmark at the beginning of the game. I had to walk uphill both ways.
I'm going to call you out on this. I'm going to go back, right? I'm going to get, there are ways to acquire version one. You're trying to backpedal now. I'm going to go version one, get rid of all the DLC. I'm going to play as Riga, and I'm going to see if that's the case. And if it's not, you're going to get a very angry tweet.
I do have to put a disclaimer here that I just got angry for comedic reasons because it was fun, though. But I remember being severely, look, it was 10 years ago, 2013. Riga was just kind of boring. I understand conquering stuff. What I don't like to play is that, like Russian stuff. And like, one thing, I like to play tall, but I like to play kind of, I like to expand, and then I like to kind of dev the provinces up. I don't develop things that are like super poor, but I'm the guy that actually clicks the expand infrastructure things where I sit down and plan like, oh, there I'm going to go, like, if it's fish, I'm going to put the special manufactory and the manufacturing, all this stuff. And you know what hurts me the most? At least right now it doesn't, but it used to. What really killed me for a while up until the latest patch. And right now it's still in a different form. If you saved your game and then loaded it, then your expand infrastructure effects would be gone and they would kill the buildings too. Right now, it isn't so. Right now, it doesn't kill the buildings. However, if you attack switch, you still have to re-expand the infrastructure to get the bonuses. But imagine my game when I, like, you know, I have a holiday. I can, like, spend 6 hours playing. I'm in 1750. I have a revolutionary republic. I think it was Dithmarschen at the time. And everything's built perfectly and my economy is great. And then I load the game and suddenly I don't even know what I did wrong because what? But yeah, he tortures his other players by making a challenge of 10 things they had to recognize in the game. And that was super. I'll tell you honestly, I didn't expect anyone to understand the cavalry thing because I don't know if you changed the physical peps. People should be able to see the peps, but I doubt you did it.
I did. I changed. So you could see that they had triple the amounts of pips. So you could see that. I say me. There's a very talented modder called Lunu I was working with. But yeah, we changed 10 things in EU4 and then sat down six players and then got them to play until they got them all. And it started out at the start. They were genuinely like, it was really funny to me because at the start, they're like, haha, oh, shucks, got that one. And then right then they were like, late, I want you to die. Like we cut a lot of stuff because Arcus, who's one of my moderators, said, I'm going to like fly to London. I'm going to break your fucking knees. I'm going to take you out. Like he got dark with it. Right? So we had to cut it all because he went real far.
Only people who listen to this show will know. Now, like, I enjoyed this because you might laugh at this again, but again, I'm a political philosopher and I saw this as a nice little social experiment. It was great. And the thing that was the most obvious to me was like one of the last things they found out because I don't know what kind of a player are you if you don't look at your ideas the first thing. I don't remember all of them, and I don't keep the wiki open. So the first thing that I do is like I know approximately what Florence does. You know, I know that they have dev cost and all this stuff, but which position, all this stuff. I look at my ideas first thing in the game. And how your guys could just miss it?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is because they are that into the game, right? They do basic things like not look at, like, for example, when you build infantry or you build cavalry, you'll open up the build menu, you'll build it. These guys don't do that. They use hotkeys, they use everything else. A lot of the time when they are looking at things that seem obvious to us because we painstakingly go through it, they don't recognize it.
Oh, no. See, the thing is that due to how I work, right, I have three different keyboards. I have a Russian keyboard, which is with a totally different layout because Russian Cyrillic is not QWERTY at all, not much related. Then I have my laptop keyboard, and then I have my regular keyboard. So if I want to memorize hotkeys in any game, I have to memorize them on three different keyboards, and I will never do that. So I use the macro builder, which, by the way, shame on you the first time you played Riga.
Oh?
Shame on you.
What did I do?
If you go to macro builder diplomacy and click the influence thing, you will clearly see the option sell indulgences there, and it will show you all the countries that you can sell them.
Yeah, I didn't realize it showed it on there. Yeah.
At least that's better than Corbin Gaming, because he didn't even read what the effect does.
Just... Dude, that was so much fun. Like, Riga was just a delight.
Look, I'm super happy because, you know what? Let me tell you about this. At least, you know, Tunis at least has Carthage and people go there. We used to joke about our country that, like, you know, Sweden has, like, all the Vikings, and we have, like, a bit of that. And, like, you know where Sweden is and
yeah.
The regions and all that stuff. You know Russia. Everyone mistakes it with Russia. You know Poland. We in the Baltics are like the default potato flavor. No one knows anything about us. We have our own traditions and culture and everything, but we're the kind of people who are like left alone to our own devices. And we've had zero terrorist attacks throughout our history. We have zero earthquakes, zero volcanoes. Nothing happens here at all. So we're super boring in a way. And, you know, it has its benefits. Peaceful.
Yeah, I would say it's boring. That's
So like when Livonia and Order got and Riga got their own ideas, that was amazing because for the first time ever, something actually interesting happens where Riga is mentioned. Because every time someone mentions Laffy in any form or media, they butcher our names and they're just awful.
Yeah.
And I genuinely like what they did with it, except that the six province thing. Why six province thing? Because, see, before I found out that Riga can form Hansa, I thought, well, what are you supposed to do? You can form Livonia, but then your issues with provinces, all this stuff, what are you supposed to do? Well, now I know that you can form Hansa.
I think it's great. I think, but that's the thing. They plan to, when I was at PDXCon most recently, they announced that they were planning two other DLCs. One's focusing on South America, and there's another one.
Yeah, South America really needs it because Nahuatl and Maya and Inca are just like, I remember when the Conquest of Paradise came out.
Yeah.
And at that point, everyone was thinking Nahuatl is the most powerful religion in the game. It was OP at that point.
It still is. It's just there's no point in going to get it.
I don't know, because I watch all these guys of... Catholic got buffed, Orthodox is always strong, I don't know.
Well, the thing is, it's like, because it's the opportunity cost, right? Nahuatl, you can get all the reforms really, really, really quickly by like switching out, and then you could develop... So the standard play... This is why Mesio is kind of boring to play in, because if you're going to play it meta and to the extreme, what you do is you flip religion to animus and you flip back and then you get all the reforms. And then you could develop Renaissance and feudalism. So you just don't need the Europeans. So by the time Europeans come, you get full use of your gold mines and you're just overpowered.
This is a question that I want to ask you. Because of my honor culture, there are certain things that I know are meta, but I just refuse to do because they seem to be so illogically ahistorical to me. Because Riga... Forming like Hansa, that's okay. We're Hansatic city, we're tied to that number. That's fine. But if you're switching time, okay, now you know there is basis in history for it, so you don't have to even feel guilty about it. But the most ahistorical thing I do is that I know that the best way how to play Byzantium is start as Venice. I don't like to do all these weird exploity things where you don't tech up when the tech is available, and then you kind of do various bizarre culture shiftings and government changings just to optimize some sort of bizarre bonuses. Because I see, look,
You call me a tall player. I call myself a role playing player. I like
yeah,
to
not
play,
the same.
I like to play the republics and places where you know you have this land because it's kind of a challenge to me.
Well, have you never played as a horde?
I have.
Who'd you play as?
Zaporozhye, of course.
What? No, have you played any of the starting hordes like Great Horde, Noga, Uzbek?
I've played as Jurchen.
No, the West ones. Come on.
No.
The West ones they're golden. You got to, quite literally.
You know what I've done? I hate playing custom nations because they feel like just wrong. The best custom nation I built, which I got the 800 point achievement from, was that I built a Vecchia Republic in the whole Victoria Lake region in Africa with ideas that like reduce all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. It was like super weird.
Nice.
Because I love special units. I don't know why. I just like them. And I made a custom nation that was like one province. I went for the 800 points, three development.
Mm-hmm.
I made myself Zaporozhye Cossacks to get the Cossacks.
Mm-hmm.
I made myself Manchu culture to get the banners.
Oh, God.
I gave myself Hussars. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I like when things aren't the default. I like when things are kind of a bit cooler.
Yeah, a little bit different, for sure.
I like to play until the very late game because I like those late game mechanics. But if you start super wide early, I could probably expand my I don't know, France. I have big blue blob. It's not that difficult. It's just I can do all the conquest things. It's just that then the game becomes too boring for me because
you're too big.
You're too big, yeah. And just it's like and but then if you play as Riga, those six provinces with the colony. First of all, you're really tied to speed. You have to figure out when to take the colonial ideas. Those provinces kind of put you in, and you know you have to go to war with like Austria to stop them from expanding. And also, one thing you'll love with Anglican Riga, to play them optimally, you don't conquer provinces, but you're constantly at war all the time with everyone. Because what you do is like you want to burn down every heretic church in Europe. That'll give you maximum power. I can assure you, you'll have like one squad doing some colonizing and then trading and everything. But if you're not at war all the time, starting from the moment you switch Anglican with all the minor little things.
Without going wide.
That's not optimal. So you'll get to enjoy massive turbo warfare, horde-ish without conquering. And also things like you get those power points and destroy things. And then you, of course, take trade power from them, which boosts your income even more. Zero aggressive expansion, and the emperor doesn't care. And like I said, you also can click the button that improves your relations with Protestant and reform countries.
Which is great. I need to do that. We were talking about it before, and I'm going to make a video out of it.
The first time, by the way, when I played in Protestant Riga, I screwed my game over because I decided to go full trade and full everything, get maximum merchants, and did like all this converting thing when they finally fixed it for it to work. But I got a bit too lucky. I stamped out Catholicism at all. It ceased to exist.
Oh, I see.
You can do that if you have like 15 merchants everywhere.
Yeah.
In Europe, no Catholic provinces. Then I understood that, oh, wait, and now Austria is still going to, you know, eat up the HRE. Then I had to destroy. Like, yeah, that's the thing with Riga. Riga is powerful. They're the most powerful at that point. My main issue with Riga was like, and what then? You kind of finish your mission tree, and the later Riga missions are like, okay, what does this supporting thing give me? What's the point?
Yeah, it's not built for late game, for sure.
I had good results, my best game. But that was before I discovered Hans. I did a lot of country shifting, annexing, losing wars and everything. I kind of shifted to Livonia myself. But in my best game, I never took exploration. I took expansion. However, the best way how to do it is expand infrastructure in Riga. I highly recommend you do get that monument, movable monument from Canada.
Well, I think Riga's interesting because it's the only nation that I enjoy playing tour with.
I don't know. You always just seem to conquer everything all the time. I'm just wary of coalitions. I haven't done a single one. I haven't done it because...
Neither have I. They're pointless. They're boring. They're really, really boring.
Not because I couldn't. I know how to form Mughals with Timurids, yes. But why? You just...
Ugh. One thing I think... E4 lacks. I think that it's inherent in CK3 because you play with characters, and it's inherent in Victoria 3 because you look at like...
Oh, Devil Worship!
Devil Worship? Man just yelled Devil Worship.
you said what EU4 lacks and what CK has, and I'm like,
dude. Well, there are one or two things. There are one or two things. Well, because you said you played CK2, not CK3, right?
I played CK3 a bit.
Yeah, but you prefer CK2.
Just because it has more content.
Yeah, of course.
Of course, I have done Viking stuff in that area and everything. It's just that, like I said, I like to play Merchant Republics because they're fun, and then you can do weird things. I have restored Rome in CK2, starting with Venice, and it was amazing. It's just that, yeah, you taught me the fact that CK3 is way more historically accurate.
Yes, it is. I don't think this is going to sound weird, but I don't think that CK3 is more historically accurate than CK2. Despite the fact that CK2 has devil worship and like weird satanic rituals and Aztecs coming in, I don't think that it is. I think they are two, I don't know if this is intentional or not, this is how I take it. They are two fundamentally different ways of interpreting history. CK3 is a very much more, if you were there, realistic sort of game.
And CK2 is the way how you perceived it.
Exactly. Like, it's like there are monsters that exist. There are this that exists. You are playing it through the historical manuscripts.
And this is why I love it, because when I started like playing these games, I discovered podcasting through Paradox Games, because I was literally sitting in 4chan downloading mods. And one of the mod folders, and there was like this thing called Hardcore History. And what the hell is that? And that's podcast.
Yeah.
That's Dan Carlin, his show, at one point, he speaks about the Punic Wars, making people think about, you know, we know all the dates and all this stuff, but, you know, you're a Roman soldier, you're standing there in your line, and you're being faced with an elephant. What it's like to face an elephant with a spear, and you see the elephant for the first time in your life.
Mm.
And that is the approach that I take in my show as well, because I gather a lot of people history as well. And this is why CK2 appeals to me, because it's about the lived experience. I know it's a fancy word to throw out right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I really mean that in a lot of history, in a lot of kind of wrong ways how to teach history, you just focus on the kings, and we all know that everything taught in schools is just the sanitized version of it anyways.
Mm-hmm.
I like to kind of think about how people actually lived and how they felt like, and that is why, for example, if you talk about art, I've been to Vatican, of course, and seen all these majestic paintings. My favorite historical art comes from the Dutch Renaissance. And you look at all these paintings of like everyday peasants' lives and these little kind of caricatures and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Kings are cool and all that whatnot, but I'm not a king, and I like to, you know, understand that where we came from, what happened there. And CK2 really gives us this stuff until it wears off into complete utter madness, of course.
Which has a tendency to do quite often.
Another thing which I was specifically told to ask you. It's about the EU4. This is one of those little questions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There are people, and I'm on your side on this one, because, like I said, you ended up being the EU4 creator that I wanted on my show to talk about. I'm really glad that you are here, because, for one, you know, a lot of history. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But there are people who state that you actually cheated when you got the Norse thing as the thing, because someone claimed that if you dig through the game files, it was literally impossible.
So let me explain that. So there's two things here, right? So the way that I did it and the way that Ludi did it was different. Ludi had it through like the Greenland event, which he got, and then people said that it was like the devs basically released something, a dev diary showing that it wasn't possible at that time. Ludi's defense was that he was working off of a early access review copy, not the full release copy, right?
Oh, you lucky gits! You get all sorts of
Yeah. So that's that. In terms of myself and cheating.
No. See, I know you didn't cheat, because you literally said a bit previously, because you like suffering. So I know you didn't cheat.
Yeah. Well, the Norse one, I didn't cheat. I have used console commands in the past to enhance videos. I've never hidden that. The way that I operate is that if you look in the top right, if you see Iron Man, then there's no console commands happening. There's no advancing. There's nothing like that. Because it's usually part of the challenge or part of the achievement, part of something else. If I'm running a mod or if I'm trying to show something off, if there's no Iron Man on the top right, it's hands off. I might be pushing things, I might not. People say that people get really in depth into it and be like, oh well, you should show off all the console commands. It kind of interrupts the flow, I found, and I don't agree with it. My simple answer is, who cares?
Also, but why? I have stopped playing Iron Man completely. Like I said, the game's still buggy. If I want to, for example, do the Teutonic Order Holy Horde achievement, Yes, I will restart until Livonian Order becomes a vassal. Why? Because I don't have I don't have so many hours to play this game. I just want to get it quickly and efficiently done.
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting thing where people came to me and said, ah, you cheated on this video. And I said, yes. And then they went, oh. Because there was a whole controversy with Ludi, where like in his guise, he was like accused of cheating and using commands and then not showing it. And then Ludi said that he didn't, which then created two factions of thought, right? Okay, he did, he didn't, that sort of stuff. So when people came to me and they said, ah, look at this, you clearly used console commands. And I said, yes. And they went, oh. Because then like, okay, now what?
As I see it, people who complain about you using console commands are people for whom I suppose the biggest problem in life is the fact that one of their favorite entertainers is actually, you know, doing something that makes the video more interesting. For me, I have a bunch of stuff to worry about more than, you know, getting into drama about whether or not you use console commands. I have real issues.
Look, like I said, if it's a challenge video, I'm not going to use console commands because that's kind of the point of the challenge. Like, if I'm trying to recreate historical context, then yeah, it's going to be Iron Man. It's going to be no console commands.
What's the most difficult challenge that you've seen from all the achievements? And by the way, not counting the Three Mountains because World Conquest are stupid, the one achievement that you actually decided to go for and it was like surprisingly difficult.
I think that there's nothing that's like truly difficult. True Air of Timur is pretty bad.
No, easy. Easy in comparison.
You think so?
Yeah.
You think so? What's your one?
Oh, it's next to that. There's this little one province miner called Garwal.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, they have an achievement for you running 52 forts with them.
Yeah.
Without deficit. Try that.
That's not hard.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I also thought that. That's harder than True Air of Timur, in my eyes. In True Air of Timur, you can manage this because if you know how coalitions work and all this stuff, you can just pull through. That Garwal thing, they start in such a bizarre diplomatic position. They're the poor and everything. It's kind of like if you try to super expand and create Queen by the High Shi, one of those fibers, it's just weird.
Do you want me to give you a quick 10-second tutorial, 20-second tutorial on how to do it?
Well, yeah, please.
Okay, here you go. Take out Delhi immediately, right? That's step one. Then you trace the, because they'll be embroiled in a war and everyone hates them. You trace north of Jampur, right, and try and border Ming as soon as possible, so you become their tributary, so you just avoid all coalitions. From there, you just conquer the rest of India and then set up your forts, because there's a gold mine and really rich provinces. It's just a time thing, that one. It's annoying. But, I mean, if you conquer India, you got it. Easy. No worries. Because then you can do your favorite thing and play tool.
At one point, conquering stuff becomes a chore, especially when you have to deal with all the rebels.
Yeah, which is why I don't really play beyond 1550 unless there's a direct, like, aim or challenge or something in front of me. You know? Or like I'll intentionally leave the Ottomans or France alone to make sure that they do it.
Then I give you a challenge for your next run with Riga. But I want to see you ending that Riga run in 1821.
Oh my god, no. I made a video where I played an entire game of EU4 in one sitting.
Oh no, don't do that in one sitting. Jeez. Okay, then I give you.
But I did it in one sitting. It's an hour and a half video because I just played speed 5, no pausing. And I just went through the entire thing. It was horrible.
I take that back. Don't do that. It's going to be miserable. Also, you mentioned one of your shorts, the kind of weird bug or exploit thing with the Horde Ming thing through Fort? What?
Yeah.
Could you explain that, please?
The Horde Ming thing.
The one where you give forts to Haishi and then things happen? How does that work?
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff you can do with like bank. Okay, we're getting super meta here. But you could like force bankrupt your vassals, right? And then you can use that to spawn different rebels.
I did this in one of my Let's Play Riga take influence is my first idea and see where it leads from. Turns out bankrupting your vassals is a really interesting thing to do.
I mean, you could do really weird stuff with the EU4, man. Like for example, you can form Mongolia and like the Mongol Empire in about less than 10 years. Because there's like a quirk you can do with spawning rebels and then you form them and then you already get the mission tree stuff you have the state. It's crazy.
That's one of the things that feels kind of stupid. I don't like, you know, people doing achievements super quickly because that feels dishonorable to me. There is this certain feeling where you see that something can be done like in the cheesy way, but it just feels dishonorable. And then you don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the entertainment value. I mean, different people get different values out of different things. You know what I mean?
About hordes, I like the raise mechanic. I think it's overpowered like terribly. I know that a lot of people consider Kazan the strongest nation in the start, which I find weird.
It is. I mean, if you want to like look at strong stations to start, it's Oira is hands down. Because you're a horde, you can take out Ming immediately, and you could just, you're that powerful that you could just completely, like, you just keep truce breaking them. It's filth.
And I wanted to ask you for advice, because there's a nation that I really want to play, but I fail this. And this is another thing. If I play as a released vassal, I never ruin my country. So, I want to play as Smolensk. Please, what do... I always die.
So you want to play as Smolensk, okay.
Moscow will support your independence, up until the point where they want to beat all your land.
Well, the thing is with Poland and Lithuania is that there's always an opportunity because they have neighbors that are typically stronger than them, right?
If you want to be a cool dude and you know, pronounce it in the proper way, never say Poland Lithuania. That's the Western stupid people.
I apologize.
Say Rzeczpospolita. That's how you say. Rzeczpospolita. Use that term.
If you're ever playing as that nation, in terms of Smolensk, right? It's just it's a waiting game to see who will support your independence. That's literally it. There will always be an opportunity. That's just how EU4 works, right? Tech advantage, that sort of stuff. Yeah. Because also you have massive power generation, because at the start, if you're a released vassal, you have 100% crown land, right? So you get an instant plus one to Diplo, admin, and mill, right? Per month because of the estates. And from there, yeah, you could just take out, you know, whether it's the Ottomans or the Muscovites or Bohemia or Austria-Hungary, or even a collection of small states that you get to just dogpile on them, which will distract the AI enough that you can rush on their capital. It's just a matter of working with what we got.
Also, I have also a question to you, because I couldn't find a guide on it. When Age of Reformation ends and Age of Absolutism begins, which privileges do you get rid of to get your absolutism up?
You want to get as high absolutism as possible. It's so key. So you just get rid of everything that affects absolutism. Everything.
Even the monarch punch.
Dude, I always get rid of it. Yeah. Because at that point, it's not as important as absolutism, personally. Because you get the admin efficiency, you get the discipline, you get everything else. See, I do know late game, so I could cheese it a little bit. You can get the, I think it's called the Crown and Court disaster, right? Which you trigger that and it'll give you absolutism as well. So you can actually, there's no point going like getting max absolutism of over 100. So if you get disasters like that and play around with it a little bit, then yeah, you can still have privileges. In which case, the monthly mill power. Or admin power if you're going wide.
Define going wide. For me, going wide is forming Russia. So, yeah.
going wide is like, okay, here's my definition of going wide. Expanding without admin.
My widest that I consider when I went really wide, okay? I have conquered all of South America and Central America as Inca.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty wide.
And I have conquered all of Africa as Congo.
Yeah, that's pretty wide. I'll give you that. That's pretty decent.
That's my wide games. And just, I don't like, I just find it tedious because I like the nice little thingies. And that is why I'm just super happy about how Riga plays, because I want to be the celestial emperor of China when I'm from King, or when I'm from Qing. I really do. But it's so bad. It's so bad. It hurts you. It makes you feel pain.
Man, I hate the, I hate this being Mandate of Heaven. I hate it. They're changing that in the new update.
By the way, if you look at the game files, this, you'll love this one. In the game files, there are things that are left in as comments and as things you can enable. I literally scoured through game files trying to figure out the mechanics on discovering Ruby stuff, right? Apparently, there's a thing in Hall of, like, you know, events and wars, one of those things, is the fact that right next to the stuff that enables League Wars, they had planned for Great Crusade, just like in CK2, and it's all in there. You just have to delete some comments. Then you can get like Crusades with like in CK2 style with like similar to League Wars. And it's there, literally said, well, we won't enable this, but if you want, you can just delete these things that can happen. And then also every Livonian government has their own description about why should you want to play this?
Dude, the Livonian, like forming your own, creating your own government type, I fully believe that's a test for EU5.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I think customization and government stuff is great. Because right now, think about it. If you play as like, there are different government types for sure, but it's not really dynamic and it doesn't evolve. And I think the evolution of a government is something that's kind of crucial, especially in this time. Like you start the game 40-44, there's no real concept of a nation state. You got a general sentiment.
Technically, nation states literally appeared after the League War with a piece of Westphalia.
Yeah, was it 1528 or 48 or something like that?
At the beginning of EU4, we're still... There are no nations, there's just land held by nobles.
1648, that's it, sorry. Just another quick check. 1648.
Well, I have a master's in history and I'm bad at dates.
No, I knew it ended in an 8, so it counts. I'm like 100 years off, but it's okay.
Like, and the UFO is going to pretty much, you know, end pretty soon. But again, it's been 10 years. 10 years.
Yeah. People have been saying it's going to end for the last 5 years. It's definitely got 2 more years in it.
Also, this is really like a nice game because everyone can like run it. It's gotten a bit popular since the beginning because in the early days, in 2013, if you played it before, then people would like, you know, people would tell me to stare you in a weird way because you're like looking at the map and making some clicks. Right now, it's a bit more popular, but it's still a bit odd.
I'm all about dynamism, me, right? So I think and this is really stupid because I'm also not a game designer, so I don't know what's mechanically possible and impossible. But when it comes to peace deals, I like the give and take because, again, during this period, it wasn't just like, okay, I'm going to dictate everything that I want and you have to accept. There was a bit more like...
But they basically said that if they would implement give and take, that would be so abusable to the nth degree.
Maybe, I don't know, it depends how you implement it. But for example, like how the Brits got Gibraltar, there was an exchange. It wasn't just like obviously, they came from a strong negotiating position.
Yes, yes, and you also got the obelisk and all the artwork and Ireland. Yes, definitely. I'm sorry, I have to poke fun of the British. It's a thing. I'm on the continental Europe, okay? It's what we do.
Yeah, and we left all that business behind. I thought we were just going to float off into the Atlantic. I don't know we'd still be around. That's what I thought Brexit meant.
No, I'm just kind of worried about this whole situation. Then again, I think we should really wrap this up because I'm getting a bit tired. It's been an hour and 40 minutes. That is going to kill me. I was, by the way, pleasantly surprised when, and this is for all you Lathe fans, Lathe is extremely polite. He always sends his emails properly with greetings and everything. I didn't expect him to do that, but he's attended some sort of posh school, I suppose, or something. I don't know.
Yeah, look, you got to hit him with the kind regards, Lathe. That's how it is. You start and end an email formally. I actually felt a little bit rude because I started my last email with hi mate and it felt very wrong. It wasn't dear sir. It was hi mate and
I am not a sir. I am a comrade.
All right, I'll say dear comrade. Next
time. I started my show so long ago that the podcasts were just new, and back then. Everyone, like on YouTube or podcasting, you get a nickname for your audience. You wouldn't call them the other. So at that point, you had to have a theme song. You had to have like the name for the audience.
A song and a dance.
If you look at these stupid, like, for example, nostalgia nerd videos or stuff like that, there was always this thing. You never said like, hi guys or something. You had like a name for your audience.
Yeah.
And for me, well, it just kind of stuck because I make a show about that stuff. So I just call everyone comrade. All those little comrades.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably should change it, but then again, hey, it's my show and it's fine. Hey, it's cool.
Nah,
it's cool.
Yeah, exactly. It's culture.
At any rate, if you ever decide to visit Riga, I'm going to show you the Palace of Riga. It's still there, by the way. It's literally a fortress next to the sea. We have one. We also have like the whole cathedral dome thing. And we, you know what's special about the Riga market? That's by the way later, but there's an interesting thing because everyone who comes to Riga uses a massive historical object, like it's a tourism object to. Like the weirdest thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally from a later era, but we built our Grand Central Market from Zeppelins, literally.
Oh, nice.
Our big anchors are Zeppelin carcasses because we have to put them somewhere. So they look weird. It's crazy, but we have like this huge market thing. It's been gentrified a lot. There used to be like farmers just there, but like now they're selling craft beer and all this stuff. So yeah, all the stuff that is like in the whole listy thing, of course, is more powerful than it was in real life. But I can show you those objects, and you can like poke.
Yeah, them. That'd be great.
And you get free beer, and you have a place to stay. Because then, friend, I hope that I can call you that way. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, and I hope that you know if you're running some multiplayer stuff, please call me on.
Will do.
And if I'll have some very British questions to ask you. I'll be sure to let you know.
Or Tunisian,
yeah.
Do you let me know, absolutely.
And to all you listeners, das vidanje, tovarishi. And as always, remember that happiness is mandatory.
Thank you for listening to the Eastern Border Show. If you have any questions or comments, go to our website, theeasternborder.lv, and leave a comment there. Or email us at theeasternborder@gmail.com. We'll be sure to answer. You can also follow us on social media and contact us there.
If you enjoyed this episode, then leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends about us. It really helps us grow the show. And remember, happiness is mandatory.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.